A child stands in a cramped Brooklyn housing project apartment, watching his father limp home from another dead-end job, defeated and without dignity. That child would grow up to build one of the world's most recognizable brands, transforming not just how Americans drink coffee, but how they experience community itself. This isn't a rags-to-riches fairy tale. It's the story of how deep personal pain can become the foundation for revolutionary empathy. The Green Mermaid logo, now adorning over 30,000 stores worldwide, began as a four-location Seattle coffee shop, but more remarkably, it became what sociologists call the essential third place in modern life. That crucial space between home and work, where we remember what it feels like to belong. Growing up in Bayview Projects wasn't dangerous, but it was soul-crushing. Schultz's father cycled through blue-collar jobs without finding his path, while his mother, Bobby, who never finished high school, insisted education was their ticket out. This modest upbringing planted two seeds: relentless drive and profound compassion for overlooked workers. Schultz became that blue-collar athlete who lacks world-class talent but outperforms everyone when it counts. Long after others stop to rest, I'm still running, chasing something nobody else can see. By 28, Schultz had achieved the American dream: $75,000 salary, company car, Manhattan apartment. He felt empty. Then in 1981, working at Hammerplast, he noticed a tiny Seattle retailer ordering unusual numbers of coffee drip brewers. Curiosity led him to Pike Place Market, where he experienced his first cup of Sumatra. Meeting owners Jerry Baldwin and Gordon Boker, who treated coffee like a sacred mission, Schultz called his wife that afternoon. "I'm in God's country. I know where I want to live, Seattle, Washington." Sometimes destiny doesn't knock, it percolates. In 1983, Schultz walked through Milan's fashion district and discovered something transformative. Italian coffee bars were neighborhood institutions where baristas became respected craftspeople. Locals gathered at marble counters, exchanging banter while enjoying perfectly crafted espressos. Schultz tasted his first cafe latte rich espresso balanced with silky steamed milk and watched coffee preparation become an immersive sensory experience. The revelation hit hard. Starbucks sold premium beans but didn't serve coffee by the cup. When Schultz returned burning with this vision, management was uninterested. After nearly a year of advocacy, Baldwin relented, allowing a tiny 300-square-foot espresso bar test. Opening day brought 400 customers, within 2 months, 800 daily. Despite this validation, Baldwin remained resistant, viewing espresso as a distraction. The philosophical divide became unbridgeable. Baldwin saw retail, Schultz envisioned revolution. Facing this impasse, Schultz made the defining choice: leave Starbucks to pursue his vision independently, or forever wonder what if. Starting fresh meant facing relentless rejection. Faima refused to sell Schultz espresso machines, insisting Americans could never appreciate espresso like Italians. His first investor, physician Ron Margulis, interrupted his business plan presentation to write a $100,000 check on the spot, investing in the person, not just the idea. This taught Schultz that passion alone doesn't guarantee success, but it remains essential. His biggest challenge was convincing investors that coffee, a declining commodity with no patents or proprietary technology, could become a growth industry. Schultz explained how they would reinvent coffee by weaving romance and community around it, similar to how Nike transformed sneakers into premium lifestyle products. Then came destiny's twist. Baldwin and Boker decided to sell the Seattle Starbucks stores, roasting plant, and name in March 1987. After arranging $3.8 million in financing, Schultz returned as owner and CEO. At their first meeting, nervous employees wondered what changes were coming. Schultz spoke from his heart: "I'm here because I love this company. I love what it represents." The small management team dreamed boldly: 125 stores in 5 years. Many called it impossible. Throughout 1987, Schultz's father's lung cancer worsened. When he died in January 1988, one tragedy stood out: he never witnessed what his son achieved. During those final months, Schultz was building trust with Starbucks employees, many showing the same doubts about management his father had expressed. Unlike his childhood helplessness, he could now address workplace insecurity. Against 1980s corporate trends, Schultz proposed extending health benefits to part-timers working just 20 hours weekly. The board questioned the expense before profitability. Schultz argued it would reduce costly turnover, $3,000 to train new hires versus $1,500 annually for benefits. The board approved, making Starbucks the only company offering full benefits to part-timers. Turnover stayed at 60 to 65% versus industry norms of 150 to 400%. When partner Jim Carrigan revealed he had AIDS, they created a policy covering terminal illnesses, supporting Jim until his death. After their first profitable year in 1990, Schultz implemented Beanstock, stock options for every employee, from managers to baristas. Warehouse workers voluntarily decertified their union, saying, "You trusted us, and now we trust you." Partners used Beanstock to buy homes, pay for college, or visit family. Between 1987 and 1989, Starbucks made expensive investments that seemed premature, hiring experienced executives, building facilities beyond current needs, and formulating clear strategies. This allowed them to accelerate growth without stopping to catch their breath. They raised substantial capital, $3.9 million just 1 year after acquisition, followed by $13.5 million in 1990 and another $15 million. Possible because revenues were rising over 80% annually while nearly doubling stores each year. They built a roasting facility in 1989 they thought would last 10 years. Schultz personally approved every store site for 5 years, over 100 locations. They hired Arthur Rubenfeld to oversee real estate, design, and construction as one integrated function, achieving a remarkable record, closing only 2 of their first 1,000 stores due to site misjudgments. Most competitors failed by not investing enough in people and systems, franchising too early, or lacking discipline in real estate economics. In August 1989, Howard Behar joined Starbucks. Unlike polite Seattleites who avoided disagreement, Behar spoke passionately, sometimes pounding tables or tearing up. His most valuable critique, Starbucks was too product-oriented. "We're not filling bellies," he'd say. "We're filling souls." Orrin Smith provided the perfect counterbalance. Quiet and reserved, he worked steadily at problems, creating appreciation for necessary disciplines. Schultz gradually recognized that building discipline doesn't stifle creativity, but strengthens it. Starbucks discovered they fulfilled deeper needs than premium coffee offering European romance, affordable luxury, urban oasis, and casual social interaction. Ray Oldenburg's third place concept perfectly described these informal gathering spots outside home and work. The 1990s brought telecommuting and early internet usage, paradoxically increasing isolation while making physical gathering places essential. By creating atmospheres they enjoyed, comfortable seating, warm lighting, curated music, Starbucks tapped into profound unmet needs. True innovation addresses irrelevant needs while inspiring emotional connection. Every business faces compromises. Some issues remained non-negotiable. No franchising, no artificially flavored beans, no supermarket sales, never compromising quality. Yet they learned to listen. The non-fat milk controversy showed their evolution from resistance to embracing choice. People long for authenticity and uplift. Millions visit Starbucks weekly for the feeling, directly related to refusing mediocrity. Success isn't measured in dollars, but in how you conduct the journey. Your work isn't just what you do, it's who you become.